Welcome. This is Cascade Church Portland's podcast. We exist to invite all people to join us as we follow Jesus together in bringing heaven to earth.
Hey, good morning. So good to see you all. And I really mean that, all of you. We talk about this from time to time, but it's one of the themes that we're going to look at this morning. You showing up here this morning. Let's just all take a moment and appreciate that you're here today. I wasn't there. I'm not a creeper. I don't know what it took to get you here. But it's not easy to show up to church, especially if it's your first time or you're coming back or maybe you just had a long week. Being here matters. And it's not something that we like see you here and we're like, well, yeah, obviously, you got to go to church on Sunday. It's an amazing gift of your presence to be here. And I really, truly believe it's not an accident. I think you're here for a reason. And I think God has something for you in the midst of this. So my hope and prayer is that you would say, okay, for the next, I'm not going to give you time, you'll watch your watches, for the next little bit, a reasonable period of time, that you would have your hearts and your ears open to say, all right, God, what do you have for me this week? What is going on? So we're going to talk about Isaiah because we are in the book of Isaiah. And to get into where we're talking about in Isaiah today, we need to start with weddings. How many of you have been to a wedding recently? And we'll say like in the last 3 months, like you, the summer wedding season. Yeah. So, all right, this is like the moment of honesty. So full permission to go half hands, all right? Those count right now. It doesn't have to be all the way up. You can go half hands and we'll accept that. How many of you, when you go to a wedding and you see that there's a wedding dance floor, you have a little bit of cringe within you? You're like, oh, no, I have somewhere to go. How many, like, when you see the wedding dance floor, you're like, no, I got a place to be, and it's not on that dance floor. Right about that when you see the bride going out for, like, the daughter-father dance, you're like, that is beautiful. Let me find someone to have a very engaging conversation with for the next 2 hours, because I am not getting out on that dance floor. Now, how many of you get excited? You're like, oh, this is my moment to shine. I've been clubbing every weeknight for this. I've been getting ready. I've been practicing my dance moves. I don't like wedding dance floors. Whew, felt good to say it. Oh, gosh, I like it. Here's the reason why. It feels like the space why I will be exposed. And some of you might say, what are you talking about? Nobody watches other people and makes judgments about how they dance on a dance floor. No, yeah, they do. How do I know? Because I do it. This is how I am sure it is a thing. Where you're like, and so I have this thing when you get out there where you're like, all right, what do I do when I'm on a wedding dance floor? Always go goofy, because if it looks terrible, hey, I'm in on the joke too. What am I doing out here? I know, I get it. It's not good. The worst move you can make on a wedding dance floor is to be super serious and sure that you are nailing it, because you might be, from the looks at you, you probably are. But if you're not, it's not a good look to be all the way in, confident that you're nailing it and not nailing it. It can be a scary, scary place. For me, I thought of the wedding dance floor, but for you, here's what I'd like you to start with, the starting thought this morning. Where's the place, where's the space where you're terrified you're going to be exposed? Where's the place where you're like, maybe for you it is your annual, I'm losing the term right now. It's not like your health checkup. At your place of business, your annual review. Maybe it's when you're meeting with your boss and you're sure this is the place where they're going to be like, so we've been monitoring your computer. Tell me about your love of solitaire. What is that all about? Maybe it's here at church. This is the place where I'm going to be exposed. This is where people are going to know all the place. There's this places and spaces in our lives that terrify us. They fill us with fear because we think it's the space where everyone's going to find out that we're a fraud. Who we pretend to be, who we talk about, who we present ourselves to be is not who we are. It's not who we are. Now, we're going to get into a story of the Bible that I think begins with that exact kind of space. And I want you to tap into that emotion because I want you to hear the voice of God to you in that space. So, if you brought your Bible, I want you to turn to Isaiah 6. We are going to look at Isaiah 6 this morning. And guys, this is where else are you going to go? We're going to talk about a little history, a little Egyptian mouth purification rituals. I mean, where else are you going to get that on a Sunday morning? I don't know. All right, here we go. Isaiah 6, starting in verse 1. In the year that King Uzziah died, I saw the Lord high and exalted, seated on a throne, and the train of his robe filled the temple. That is an impressive robe. Above him were seraphim, each with six wings. With two wings they covered their faces, with two they covered their feet, and with two they were flying. And they were calling to one another, "Holy, holy, holy is the Lord Almighty. The whole earth is full of his glory." Continuing on in verse 4, it says, "At the sound of their voices, the doorpost and threshold shook, and the temple was filled with smoke. Woe to me, I cried, I am ruined, for I am a man of unclean lips, and I live among a people of unclean lips, and my eyes have seen the King, the Lord Almighty." And from the continuing on in verse 6, it says, "Then one of the seraphim flew to me with a live coal in his hand, which he had taken from the tongs of the altar. With it he touched my mouth and said, 'See, this has touched your lips. Your guilt is taken away and your sin atoned for.'" Now, most of you are familiar with the seraphim, you know, the flying ones that cover their eyes and their feet. We use this idea, the seraphim is talked about, but it actually would have been for the people hearing this prophecy, this vision that Isaiah had. Seraphim would have been something they understood, because for Egyptian gods, the seraphim were winged cobras, serpents, which... Can we just stop and think about that for a second? As if regular cobras weren't terrifying enough, throw a pair of wings on them. So they were winged cobras that were the protectors of the gods. So if you threatened the god, if you got too close to the gods were in trouble, the seraphim would come down and attack them. Here's why this is interesting. A lot of times we think, well, like the Bible, no, has all this stuff, and they just deliver all that, like no one's ever heard of a seraphim before. No. They're using the concept of seraphim, which would have been known all around the area, and they're saying, but these seraphim are different. There's something different here because it's exposing something about the nature of this god. Here's what's awesome. The Egyptian gods required protection. This god requires no protection. The seraphim have been reassigned to new duties. This god needs no protection, but the presence of this god elicits praise. The presence of this god makes you want to sing and call out, "Holy, holy, holy is the Lord God Almighty." Now, the next part is covered singing cobras. We've all seen that, right? We've been there. And immediately Isaiah is like, woe to me. This is the wedding dance floor. This is the wrong space at the wrong time. I should expose me here because this God, this holy, I will be exposed for who I truly am in this place. I'm a person of unclean lips. There is a fault in me. I don't belong in the presence of God. I shouldn't be here. And what's beautiful is that we see that this calling out, I don't belong to be here, that the seraphim and God meets Isaiah in this place and doesn't say, no, it's cool, don't worry about it, but says, no, the fact that you see it is beautiful. Now we can do something about it. Now, the reason why this is also significant, you remember at the start it said, now the time of this vision came at the death of King Uzziah. If you go and read in 2 Chronicles chapter 26, it talks about King Uzziah and his kingdom and how it all worked. One of the stories from the time of King Uzziah is he's the king, he's a big deal, he does what he wants. He decided to go into the temple, into the Holy of Holies to worship God. Now you might think, What a very pious king. That's a great thing to do. But in fact, in the way that the Israelite temple was set up is that the Holy of Holies was only available and present for the priestly tribe, the Levites. They would be the ones to go in there. So he walked in like, I'm good. It says 80 priests walk in with him like, hey, you should not be in here right now. He becomes enraged that they would question his authority, his rightness in the presence of God. He becomes angry, starts cursing them, and he is immediately stricken with leprosy. So, at the death of Uzziah, what did King Uzziah say? In the presence of God, with flying seraphim singing the song, he's like, this is kind of where I belong. Finally, I can be around someone that gets me, you know, this pure and spotless God. We get each other. Let's have a private chat. There's this idea that in the presence of God, he said, this is where I belong, and he wasn't identifying the pride within him. We're going to talk more about the sin word. He didn't identify the sin within him. This is what's important to note. I hope you all catch this. The presence of God doesn't require faultlessness. The presence of God doesn't demand of us that we are holy and spotless and without sin. No, the presence of God only has an issue with the sin you refuse to acknowledge. The presence of God invites confession. The presence of God says, hey, let's get real. You avoid the wedding dance floor of your life like 90% of the time. Not here. No, we don't have to do that here. This is a place where we acknowledge the person that didn't acknowledge leprosy. In this story, there's purification. And in the next part, God, me, who will I send? And Isaiah's like, here I am, send me. Here I am, send me. Also, that mouth purification, and we'll just do like a little step here because it might be interesting. If it's not, ignore it. For the Egyptians, there's a couple of different things that they believed. So when you died, they thought like the afterlife would continue and you need to eat and drink. So they had this ritual of the mouth opening. They would open your mouth after you had died because they believed that the mouth was the pathway to the body. It was the pathway to who you are. So there's already this cultural significance around them, around the mouth. And they also had a mouth purifying ceremony of their idols. It's a fascinating thing. They'd have these big idols, and they would do this thing where they would purify and clean the mouth of the idol to kind of consecrate it. And they'd say it was built with human hands, but now it's clean. And the reason for that was it was believed if you clean the mouth, it's a purification of the entire body. Again, this cultural idea. So the question is, I'm of unclean lips. This wasn't just a man with a potty mouth. Are you with me? He didn't just have a swearing problem. What he's saying is the mouth is a pathway to the entirety of the being and who I am. I'm a person that is gripped with anger, fear, shame, addictions. I'm a person that's gripped with sin, and the purification of the mouth is to purify the whole body. Is sin a word that you guys are familiar with? And again, you can go half hands. I'm cool with it. But like, how many of you have heard growing up with the idea of sin? Okay. Yeah. Let's talk about sin for a little bit. When I've thought of sin in the past, sin has been the thing. Like what it is sin is the great disqualifier. So imagine God, right? The robe that fills the whole temple. He's hanging out and God is standing in front of like just a conveyor belt of tomatoes. They're just going by. Yeah, have you ever seen like these videos? I do a lot of product, but like all the workers stand by the conveyor belt of tomatoes. And what do they do if a green one comes? Or one that's like horrible. It's just like whoop. For me, sin has been the disqualifier. I'm coming down the conveyor belt and my sin is the green in my tomato. My sin is like there's half a tomato missing. And God is clearly going to identify my sin and like, no, you do not belong here. This thing has to go. Now, if you can identify with that. If you've heard the word sin, the concept of sin, the things that we do wrong, these are the things that disqualify us from Christian participation, disqualify us from community with God, being in relationship with God, then something interesting happens. If you feel like you're going to be disqualified for something, we tend to become a bit defensive. Imagine being a tomato coming down. You're like, I really hope I'm surrounded by much greener tomatoes. I really hope the one I'm next to looks far worse. And you're so busy disqualifying that tomato that I'm able to slip on by. And culturally, we do this. The Christian community has done this, where we create this grading on the curve of sin. And like, I've done sins, but like that person's murdered someone. Have you seen so-and-so's anger problem? Ugh, ugly. I've done some stuff, but I haven't embezzled like Tim in accounting. We create a bell curve because it's about disqualification. So if I can just get enough other people or other things, or in the Christian community, if I can point out other disqualifications in others, then maybe my disqualifications won't be so bad. It won't be brought on display. I don't think this is what the biblical picture of sin is. I think it's a little different. The sin within us is a lot like my miniature wiener dog, Frank. Old Frank the Tank, 14 years old, half blind, 80% deaf. He's a gem. Frank hasn't spent a lot of time investing in his 401k. You know what I mean? Frank isn't thinking a lot about the future. Frank is fixated with a couple of things. It used to be the doorbell when he could hear it. Bless his sweet little heart. But it's about food, the ability to go to the bathroom, which has now become like a just wherever. That's just a thing. It's about food, it's about the bathroom, and it's about sleeping. It's all this immediate. He experiences some sort of discomfort. He experiences some sort of panic. Something happens in and around him, and he wants to immediately react. Frank has never once in his little miniature dachshund brain ever thought, you know, if I keep up this barking behavior, I might annoy my owners. He's like, there is a threat at the door right now, and we must alert everybody to it. And he ramps it up. He's like, no one's listening. Louder. That's what we have to do. You have miniature wiener dogs in your heads, in your brains. You're tired. You're angry. You're stressed. Life's hard. And there's a thing within your brain that says, let's take care of this immediately. Let's take care of this immediately. I'm having too much relational drama. I don't like how close you are at me, so I'm going to start yelling at you. That will get the space that I need. I feel awful right now. I feel overwhelmed with work. And you know what always works? Alcohol. Just as a sidestep, we like to talk about drugs and intoxicants and food, sex, all these things that we take into our, why do we do it? And like the people that are addicted, they're so weak. Why do we do it? It works every time. It works every time. And the wiener dog in your brain only cares about what works right now. There's no future planning. We have this thing within us. Our sin isn't the thing that will disqualify us in the presence of God. It's the thing that's just trying to handle the complexity of life right now. God did not create us to be gripped with the overwhelming pain and difficulty of existing. God didn't create us to go from the thing that doesn't work to the thing that doesn't work to the thing that doesn't work. And if we only think of sin as the thing that will disqualify us in the presence of God, usually what we end up doing is we just trade the culturally inappropriate sins for the culturally appropriate ones. I'm going to stop drinking because apparently I'm making a scene at parties, but you know what? I'll just put in 2 extra hours at work every night. Workaholism's awesome. Overworking, you get promotions for that. So sin isn't the thing that will disqualify us in the presence of God, the thing that we have to hide from God so that we can sneak past or get through or continue having a presence in a community or a church. Sin is the thing that we make known so we can be set free. God didn't create you to live at the mercy of the wiener dog in your head. God didn't create you to live at the mercy of just trying to respond to the immediate thing. I'm tired now, I'm angry now, I'm frustrated now, I'm trying to deal with the pain and the difficulty and this broken relationship and this way that I was passed over and this way that people haven't seen me or mistreated me. God doesn't want you to live in that cycle. So this is how we step into it and we make it known. Sin does not disqualify us. Sin does not disqualify us. And in the story of Isaiah here, when we look at what happened with King Uzziah, actually not acknowledging our sin disqualifies us. Ignoring our sin disqualifies us. And here's the thing, because let's get it. This is the thing I struggled with so much in Christianity. And I was like, nah, I'm not buying that. When we say things like, well, there, like sin is sin. And I'm like, ish. Sin is sin, but me sneaking 5 extra cookies after bedtime isn't murdering a person. Yes, true. But this is what the sin is sin concept is trying to get at. It's acknowledging those are way different reactions that have far different consequences, but it's tied to the same thing. That I don't want to deal with and acknowledge the pain, the complexity, that how hard life can be, and I'm just trying to find a way out. 3 hours of Netflix before I just fall asleep watching it allows me to press pause and to not acknowledge all the things that are going on in life. And too often we're interested in not acknowledging. And then when we end up in the presence of God, or when people say, how are you? Or what's going on within you? You're like, life is good. Because we've spent so much time running from the thing within us that we're afraid of, instead of saying, this thing is there. As a pastor, you hold this unique space. And sometimes you get to talk to people when their life has come off the rails, so to speak. Like there's not a lot of other people around. In that space, I've never met someone that's like, I like this. This was worth it. Every single one of them said, I wish I would have identified this sooner. I wish I would have been honest with myself sooner. I wish I would have told someone about this sooner. And I think what holds us back is we're afraid it's going to disqualify us from relationships, it's going to disqualify us from life, it's going to disqualify us from service to God or presence to God or whatever the thing or the voice in your head is telling you, you have to keep this a secret, you have to keep this a secret. It's killing us. It's killing us. Please don't keep it a secret. It doesn't disqualify you. It qualifies you. And God wants to deal with it because you were created to be free, not to live in the grips of chasing immediate to immediate. Are you with me? Come on. Come on. This is like the best stuff I'm ever going to say. So if you're not into this, I got nothing for you. Okay. Now we're going to look at Isaiah 9. We're going to keep going in this story. And here's the reason why, because it all ties back together. Isaiah 9, one part of the reason we looked at Isaiah is during Christmas time, we really get into and we talk about these are the prophecies of Jesus. Isaiah is the book that talks about this king that will come. And so we want to look at some of these as we kind of already looked at a little bit of the context. You have, and if you weren't here for it, don't worry. Isaiah is the prophet. He's speaking out to the nation Israel, who is running between two superpowers, the Assyrian kingdom and the Babylonian kingdom. They have no power. Their leadership is just figuring out which global superpower do we align with so we can be okay. Some within their society, by aligning with those different superpowers, have all this money and all this influence and all this wealth, while most people have nothing. And Isaiah is speaking out and like, how did you get here? God did not create you for this. As a nation, as God's chosen people, you weren't created to be this thing. And so there's very much this heart and this vision to speak into that. And then also, and what we're going to look at in verse 9, talk about what's coming. What's the hope? It's not all doom and gloom. So Isaiah 9, we're going to look at verses 2 through 7. The people walking in darkness have seen a great light. On those living in the land of deep darkness, a light has dawned. You have enlarged the nation and increased their joy. They rejoice before you as people rejoice at the harvest, as warriors rejoice when dividing the plunder. For as in the day of Midian's defeat, you have shattered the yoke that burdens them, the bar across their shoulders, the rod of their oppressor. Every warrior's boot used in battle and every garment rolled in blood will be destined for burning, will be fuel for the fire. For to us a child is born, to us a son is given, and the government will be on his shoulders. He will be called Wonderful Counselor, Mighty God, Everlasting Father, Prince of Peace. Of the greatness of his government and peace there will be no end. He will reign on David's throne and over his kingdom, of the Lord, establishing and upholding it with justice and righteousness. From that time on and forever, the zeal of the Lord Almighty will accomplish this. So you might be used to this. This is something that we sing, we talk about, for unto us a child is born. And we talk about these different names, Prince of Peace. This is who Jesus is. Now, a quick note. There's debate and question. Are they talking about Jesus here? Or are they talking about King Hezekiah, the king who would have been coming during that time that they believe that he will be the one to reestablish it? Here's the great thing about the Bible. I bet there were many that thought this was King Hezekiah. The reason why we read this in Christmas time now is because as we look back over the whole story, where they came from and where they were, we say the ultimate fulfillment of this vision was Jesus. And this is what's important to note. And it's Jesus because he did it in predicted, totally unforeseen ways. No one ever would have predicted, especially in the time of Jesus, that Jesus' life and ministry was accomplishing this vision, a Prince of Peace. Because they were certain the only way to get there was warfare. The only way to get there was to win, was to be defeat the military battle. So even during this time, they're listening to the Isaiah prophet speak out, and they're like, yes, awesome. God will finally give us someone who will lead us into military battle and victory over the Babylonians or the Assyrians. They were stuck in this mentality that the only path to freedom is this. Hang with me now. Are you with me? There are people today where we look back and we're like, silly Israelites, they don't see it. Clearly Jesus, I got it. But this is a human condition. This isn't an Israelite condition. We get stuck in the way we think our freedom or our liberation will come in this way, and we aren't open to seeing what God is doing now. The life and ministry of Jesus isn't just the thing that sets it, it's the template for how life in the world works. So if all you learn from the life of Jesus is to be more certain you know how it's going to work in the future, I don't know that you were paying attention. Because the very life of Jesus was the unexpected thing. So how do we say, I'm listening to Jesus, I'm walking this message, I'm seeing who he is, and in one hand, and in the other hand, I'm holding, and it could be unexpected. It could be different. God could surprise me. In the time of Jesus, the people that were certain they couldn't be surprised weren't the heroes. The Pharisees and Sadducees, who were sure they were right, they weren't the ones that got it. And this isn't about being right and wrong. I'm not trying to say, like, if you hold great certainty into how God works and how he's moving the world and how it's going to be, you're going to be against Jesus bad and you're going to be the green tomato getting plucked off. I'm saying, wouldn't it be better to have experienced Jesus in the day? I mean, if you were there, wouldn't it have better to be hanging out with Jesus? So the way to do that isn't to study Jesus and be like, I got it. I got the template. That was the problem. That's why people miss Jesus, is they were certain they had it. Holding uncertainty is a part of what Jesus is inviting us to. And it also translates to how we understand our sin, the things that we're not in. Am I open to my solutions may not be the ones that are going to lead me out of this? That's usually where addictions come in, is when people are certain they know how to pull themselves out or they know how to get themselves out. And usually the thing that keeps us in silence is certainty that we can take care of it on our own, which is a story of culture. It's a story of the pioneers and the people that figured it out and charted their own path. It's just not the story of the Bible. So let's talk about Kenya, 1989 for a second. You all know I was going there. In Kenya, 1989, President Moi had this issue. One of the greatest economic forces in Kenya was tourism. And why would people go to Kenya for tourism? Have you ever seen an elephant up close? Woo, it's delightful. Elephants are amazing. But from 1979 to 1989, the elephant population in Kenya had been taken from 72,000 to 17,000, a number which continued to fall. And so the nation, the country of Kenya, had a decision. What do we do? They'd been cracking down on poachers. They had been saying that you cannot poach. They had been more diligent, but they didn't know how to finally address the poaching problem. And they had all this ivory that they had confiscated. It was over 20 tons of ivory. Let that sink in. 20 tons of ivory. And so you know what they did in 1989 with 20 tons of ivory valued at $3 million? They said, if we sell this ivory to pay for greater groups of people that can go at the poachers, we're actively going to be contributing to the poacher system. We're going to create more value in ivory by selling it all, which is going to incentivize people. We're in an arms race. So they burned $3 million worth of ivory. And they've actually done it again in Kenya. They just burned it. Which on one thought, that has to smell awful. I can't imagine that smells good, you know? Like, you don't gather around an ivory campfire. I think this is the same imagery that they're using in Isaiah when he talks about the warrior's boot and the robes of blood, the claws of blood. Like, they're thrown into that through milk. Here's the imagery that's so important there. The belief is that through military might, we are going to figure out who we are as a nation. Individuals, issues of sin, by my own personal might, I will overcome this thing and then I will become successful. The invitation of Scripture is that we surrender, that there's this path of violence as a nation which will make us truly peaceful. There's a path of violence and warfare that will truly lead us to become the people God created us to be. It sounds insane when you hear it, right? There's a war we're going to fight, and then we will truly be godly. When we kill X number of people, then we will have arrived at this. And while you hear that and like, that's insane, well, of course they didn't see Jesus. Duh. You, me, us. We fight wars within ourselves constantly. We believe that through willpower, and we believe that through hiding our greatest fears and our greatest angers and the things within us, we will ultimately defeat and destroy the sin within us, the thing that is attacking us, the thing that runs through your head when you put your head on the pillow and you're alone. God is inviting us to another path. I think this is ultimately, as we look at the story and say, no, this is who Jesus came to be. He's inviting us to surrender those tools that we've traditionally used, which have never worked. Are you seeing the parallels? Warfare has never worked. We don't leave at more peace today because we have bigger and greater militaries. We just don't. It hasn't worked. I know this is shocking. more armies and warfare and more weapons and bombs leads to more warfare. It doesn't lead to more peace. Individually in our own lives, more of the thing striving and trying to take control, more pushing and suppressing of the things within us that haunt us and keep us up at night has not ever led to more freedom and liberation. The invitation to Jesus is to walk the path of Isaiah. This is the thing within me. I'm going to lay it bare to God, and I'm going to lay it bare to another human being, living, breathing. Jesus came to set us free by making our violence obsolete. Jesus came to set us free by making our violence obsolete. It just doesn't work anymore. It doesn't work anymore to ramp up this violence internally, externally. We choose a different path. We walk in another direction. That's the path that Jesus is inviting us to. Last thing, let's talk about grace. Statement of, I've grown up in the church. I'm not saying it like that makes me better or anything. It's just statement of fact. Some of my earliest memories are in church, and there's something interesting about growing up in the church and being around it for a long time. There's certain concepts that just don't mean as much to me anymore because I've convinced myself I should have gotten it by now. Like I'm jonesing for a new thing. I want Jesus to show me something new. And so recently I've become a little like, meh, when it comes to grace. That God's come to bring you grace. Jesus came to bring you grace. Grace is this unmerited gift, this fact that you receive what you didn't deserve. You've done something. You've thought something. You've walked down a path where like the outcomes to that are certain kind of justice or repercussions. And God says, no, there's a grace that I've extended to you. And when I hear about grace, I'm like, oh, okay, whatever. I'm going to find some other path. When it comes to our issues of sin, this is where I think grace is the most important thing and something we have to become very reacquainted with. Let's talk about myself. Where does my sin become evident? When I lose my temper with my kids. When I become annoyed that they're not doing something fast enough. I've told you 4 times to clean your room. Which, think about that for a second. It's insanity to be like, I've told a 6-year-old 4 times to clean their room, and they haven't done it. No one gasped, okay? Just stating the reality, no one went, oh my gosh, what out-of-control children do you have? You all said, yeah, no, that sounds like a 6-year-old to me. And yet, I escalate, and how could you do this? And when I hear myself speaking that harshly to a 6-year-old for not hearing me and cleaning my room, I immediately encounter shame. What is wrong with me? You have your own thing. Part of who you can come tell me privately afterwards. You have your thing, your space, where this part of who you are, you surprise yourself in the way that you have acted out. Maybe for you, it's an addiction. Maybe in you, it's an escape. Maybe in you, it's in a violence or a words that you use or a thing that you do, but we have this moment where we see ourselves doing it and we are ashamed. You got choices. Either you actually accept grace in that moment and you say, nope, I'm still in the presence of God. I can still stand in this presence of God and I can own that part of myself, which I hate, and I can say, yep, it's still there. Or I can try and believe that through more rules, regulations, by saying, I'll just engage with my kids' lefts, that will help me out. I'll try and get more sleep. I'll create more rules and expectations on how I will do certain things, and that will be the thing that will save me and take care of me. Or we say, I'm going to lean into the grace of God, a grace of understanding it's okay. It's okay that I did this thing. I'm going to receive the grace that God has already given me. Jesus has already given me to be able to step forward, to choose a different path, to see what God's path is leading me, to bring freedom, where I'm not the person that's stuck in this loop of becoming overwhelmed, overcome, yell at my kids, feel shame. Overwhelmed, overcome, yell at my kids, feel shame. Grace breaks these cycles. And grace allows us to be open and honest with one another, to both share and receive grace. There's something powerful about receiving this grace from another human being. You can admit all your shameful things to God, all the ways that you struggle to God. You should. Keep so holy. Yes. And it keeps a hold on us until we speak it to like another human being, another person with the image of God planted within them. So I'm being a little unrelenting right now. I get it. But the next step I'm asking you to do is the thing that is holding on to you. One, would you see it not as the thing that disqualifies you? It's actually the thing that makes you human. And it certainly doesn't disqualify you in the eyes of God. Only ignoring it does. And two, would you find another human being, living, breathing person to say, this is the thing about myself I'm ashamed of. This is the cycle that I'm stuck in. This is the thing which is gripping me. When we do that, we throw boots meant for war and robes of blood in the fire. We let the ivory burn, and we see something that is renewed and restored. Step to, oh, there's the coal brought to our lips that is meant to purify. The first step to overcoming these ways that we were not created to be is to acknowledge their existence, and we acknowledge them to one another. So here's what we're going to do. Turn to your neighbor, say your darkest sin. I'm kidding, that comes later. But what we are going to do, as we talked about this, is there's this sense, a thread throughout this I hope you've heard, is actually community and how we meet and put a face to a face. And so we've set aside time at the end of our service to actually talk to the people next to you. And for some of you, turning and talking to the people next to you is your wedding dance floor. That's okay. That's okay. The reason why we do it is just to be able to talk, to make known, to have a conversation, to know who am I around, and to think deep inside your head, they're really super sinful. They struggle with something. I'm kidding. Please don't do that. We encounter the humanity. It helps us unlock something about the image of God. It's something we believe strongly. This is what we see. This is how we interact with one another. So I'm going to pray, and then I'm going to invite you all to kind of turn to be able to meet face-to-face, say a name, and we have some questions that aren't about your deepest sin. They're about fun things, to be able to talk. May it be the first step of practice in talking to another person. Let's talk first about your favorite fall food, and then how do we also have a conversation with someone about the stuff that's within us that's gripping us, okay? Let's pray.